Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in Genesis, starting in chapter 12. This is the story, of course, is Abraham. And go from Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 17. It ends, of course, at the last verse 17. Yehovah said to Abram, "Go for yourself from your land, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and to him who curses you, I will curse. And all the families of the earth shall be blessed themselves by you." So Abram went as Jehovah had commanded him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai and Lot, his brother's son, and all their wealth that they had amassed, and the souls they made in Haran. They left to go to the land of Canaan, and they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed into land as far as the site of Shechem, and to the plain of Moreh. The Canaanite was then in the land. Jehovah appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to Jehovah, who appeared to him. From there he relocated to the mountain east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. He built there an altar to Jehovah and invoked Jehovah by name. Then Abram journeyed on and journeying steadily toward the south. There was a famine in the land, and Abram descended into Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it occurred, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, "See now, I have known that you are a woman of beautiful appearance. And it shall occur, when the Egyptians will see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but you they will let live. Please, say that you are my sister, that it may go well with me, for your sake, and that I may live on account of you." But it occurred with Abram's coming to Egypt, the Egyptians saw the woman was very beautiful. When the officials of Pharaoh saw her, they lauded her for Pharaoh. The woman was taken to Pharaoh's house, and he treated Abram well for her sake. And he acquired sheep, cattle, donkeys, slaves and maidservants, female donkeys and camels. But Jehovah afflicted Pharaoh along with his household with severe plagues because of the matter of Sarai, the wife of Abram. Pharaoh summoned Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she is your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I would take her as my wife? Now go, here is your wife, take her and go." So Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they escorted him and his wife and all that was his. So Abram went up from Egypt, he with his wife and all that was his, and Lot with him, to the south. Now Abram was very laden with livestock, silver and gold. He proceeded on his journeyings from the south to Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at first, between Bethel and Ai, the site of the altar which he had erected there at first. And there Abram invoked Jehovah by name. Also Lot went with him. Abram had flocks, cattle, and tents, and the land could not support them dwelling together, for the possessions were abundant, and they were unable to dwell together. And there was a quarreling between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. And the Canaanites and the Perizzites were then dwelling in the land. So Abram said to Lot, "Please, let there be no strife between me and you, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not all the land before you? Please, separate from me. If you go to left, then I will go right. If you go to the right, then I will go left." So Lot raised his eyes and saw the entire plain of the Jordan that was well watered everywhere. Before Jehovah had destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of Jehovah, like the land of Egypt going toward Zoar. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed from the east. Thus they parted, one from his brother. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, while Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched tents as far as Sodom. The people of Sodom were wicked and sinful toward Jehovah exceedingly. Jehovah said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, raise now your eyes and look out from where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land that you see, to you I will give it, and to your descendants forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth. So if one can count the dust of the earth, then your offspring too can be counted. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I give it to you. I will give it to you. And Abram moved his tent and came and dwelt the plains of Mamre, which are in Hebron. He built there an altar to Jehovah. And it happened in the days of Arphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, Hadolomar, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, that these made war on Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinav, king of Adma, Shimbir, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these had joined at the valley of Siddim, now the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Hedolomar, and they rebelled 13 years. In the 14th year, Hedolomar and the kings who were with him came and struck Rephaim at Ashtaroth-Karnim, and the Zuzim in Ham, and Emim at Shiveh-Kirathim, and the Horites in the mountains of Seir, as far as the plain of Paran, which is by the desert. And then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, which is Kadesh. They struck all the territory, the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazaron Tamar. The king of Sodom went forth with the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Adma, and the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, which is Zoar, and engaged them in battle in the valley of Siddim, with Hadolomar, king of Elim, Tidal, king of Goyim, Aramphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, 4 kings against 5. The valley of Siddim was full of bitumen wells. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell into them, while the rest fled into a mountain. They seized all the wealth of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their food they departed. They captured Lot and his possessions, Abram's nephew. They left, for he was residing in Sodom. Then there came the fugitive and told Abram the Ivri, who dwelt in the plains of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol, the brother of Adner, these being Abram's allies. When Abram heard that his kinsman was taken captive, he armed disciples who had been born in his house, 318. He pursued them as far as Dan, and he, with his servants, deployed against them at night and struck them. He pursued them as far as Hobah, which is to the north of Damascus. He brought back all the possessions. He brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, as well as the women and the people. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from defeating Hadolomar, and the kings that were with him to the valley of Sheveh, which is the king's valley. But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God the Most High. He blessed him, saying, blessed is Avram of God the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. And blessed be God the Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand. And he gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Avram, give me the people and take the possessions for yourself. Avram said to the king of Sodom, I lift up my hand to Jehovah, God the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. If so much as a thread to a shoe strap, or if I shall take anything from yours, so that you shall not say, it is I who made Abram rich. Far from me. Only what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who accompanied me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, they will take their portion. After these events, the word of Jehovah came to Abram in the vision, saying, fear not, Abram. I am a shield for you. Reward is very great. And Abram said, my Lord, Jehovah, what can you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is the Damascene Eliezer? Then Abram said, see to me, you have given me no offspring, and see, my steward inherits me. Suddenly the word of Jehovah came to him, saying, that one will not inherit you. Only he that shall come forth from within you shall inherit you. He took him outside and said, gaze now toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them. He said to him, so shall your offspring be. He trusted in Jehovah, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. He said to him, I am Jehovah who brought you out of Ur Kasdim to give you this land to inherit it. He said, my Lord, Jehovah, whereby shall I know that I am to inherit this? He said to him, take to me three heifers, three goats, three rams, a turtle dove, and a young dove. He took all these to him, and he cut them in the center and placed each piece opposite of his counterpart. The birds, however, he did not cut up. The birds of prey descended upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. And it happened, as the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, a dread, great darkness fell upon him. Said Abram, know with certainty that your offspring shall be aliens in a land that is not their own. They will serve them, and they will oppress them 400 years, but also the nation that they will serve I shall judge, and afterwards they will leave with great wealth. As for you, you shall come to your ancestors in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. And the fourth generation shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites shall not yet be full until then. So it happened, the sun set, and it was very dark. And behold, there was a smoky furnace and a torch of fire, which passed between these pieces. On that day, Jehovah made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. Sarai said to Abram, see now, Jehovah has restrained me from bearing. Consort now with my maidservant. Perhaps I'll be built up through her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. So Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maidservant, after 10 years of Abram's dwelling in the land of Canaan, and gave her to Abram, her husband, to him as a wife. He consorted with her, and she conceived, and when she saw she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. So Sarai said to Abram, the outrage against me is due to you. It was I who gave my maidservant to you into your bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became lowered in her esteem. Let Jehovah judge between me and you. Abram said to Sarai, behold, your maidservant is in your hand. Do to her as you see fit. And Sarai dealt harshly with her, so she fled from her. An angel of Jehovah found her by the spring of water in the desert, at the spring of the road of Shur. He said, Hagar, maidservant of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going? She said, I am running from away from Sarai, my mistress. The angel of Jehovah said to her, return to your mistress, and submit yourself to her domination. The angel of Jehovah said to her, I will greatly increase your offspring and they will not be counted for their abundance. And an angel of God said to her, behold, you will conceive and give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael, for Yahweh has heard your prayer. He shall be a wild ass of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And over all his brothers he shall dwell. She called the name of Yahweh, who spoke to her, you are the God of vision. For she said, could I have seen even here after having seen? Therefore the well was called the well of the living one appearing to me. It is between Kadesh and Bereh. Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son that Hagar bore him Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. When Abram was 99 years old, Jehovah spoke to Abram and said to him, I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be perfect. I will set my covenant between me and you. I will increase you most exceedingly. Abram threw himself upon his face, and God spoke with him, saying, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be a father of a multitude of nations. Your name shall no longer be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you most exceedingly fruitful, and make nations of you, and kings shall descend from you. I will ratify my covenant between me and you, and between your offspring after you, throughout the generations as an everlasting covenant, to be a God to you and to your offspring after you. I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of your sojourns, the whole land of Canaan as an everlasting possession, and I shall be a God to them. God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall sleep, keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout your generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. At the age of 8 days, every male among you shall be circumcised throughout your generations. He that is born of the household or purchased with money from any stranger who is not of your offspring, he that is born in your house or purchased with your money shall surely be circumcised. Thus a covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. An uncircumcised male who will not circumcise the flesh of his foreskin, that soul shall be cut off from its people. And he has invalidated my covenant. And God said to Abram, as for Sarai, your wife, do not call her name Sarai, for Sarah is her name. I will bless her. Indeed, I will give you a son through her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of peoples will rise from her. And Abram threw himself on his face and laughed, and he thought, shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? And shall Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth? And Abram said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live in your before you. And God said, nonetheless, your wife Sarah will bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. And I will fulfill my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. But in regarding Ishmael, I have heard you. I have blessed him, will make him fruitful, will increase him most exceedingly. He will beget 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. But I will maintain my covenant through Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year. When he had finished speaking with him, God ascended from upon Abraham. Then Abraham took his son Ishmael and all those servants born in his household and all those he had purchased for money, all the male members of Abraham's household, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskin on that very day, as God had spoken with him. And Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised the flesh of his foreskin. And his son Ishmael was 13 years old when he was circumcised the flesh of his foreskin. On that very day, as Abraham circumcised with Ishmael his son, and all the people of his household, born in his household and purchased with money from a stranger, were circumcised with him. Good fun story. Lech Lecha. That was Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 17. There's a whole bunch of stuff in here. There's no way I'll cover all of it. Just accept that. But there's a lot of stuff you can cover and a lot of perspectives and details with this topic. We've covered this topic multiple times, of course, over the years. And every time you cover a given topic, you can approach it in totally different ways each time. It's how you want to cover it, how you want to approach it. So before I go into my spiel, any comments, opinions, questions, or issues you have with what we read about? Yes, Deborah.
I was just thinking, you know, I was listening to this during the week that had Hagar not submitted to her mistress, they probably wouldn't be. I mean, that's his son. That's a big nation. Is that the Muslim nation?
Okay.
Or
so,
they don't know. You know, I went back and thought maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
There's so if you want to put a pinpoint name or identity on Ishmael, you can't. Even on a pinpoint a detailed name on what you find out later about Jacob Esau, thank you, Jacob's brother Esau, you can't pinpoint the exact identity of who's who. But I will tell you this: it says Ishmael produces obviously 12 sons as a prince as he comes. Now, if you note very carefully, God's promise was Ishmael would become a great nation, singular, not nations, but nation. While Isaac gets a blessing of nations, plural. So you get more than one. And also, even though Ishmael gets princes after him, but in Isaac's, the promise goes through Isaac, is kings of peoples. They're both plural. So as opposed to kings of a people, that's, for example, kings of a people, people singular, means kings, multiple kings of a particular nation, or particular group of people. But they're kings, plural, of peoples, plural, which is identifying as different nations of different kings of those nations will all come through Abraham's line through Isaac. Now, I'm not going to exclude Esau in that promise, just Abraham through Isaac, because you could include Esau too. But Ishmael gets a particular nation that has multiple rulers over it and runs it. Now, you can debate what that means, in that many of the descendants of Ishmael continue on. We read about them later on. They have a whole genealogy of multiple generations for Ishmael, as far as who he has and all those nations produced from them. And you could also note in history and all the different details of migration patterns and blah, blah, blah. Those are all speculative ideas. We don't know who did what. And just as we don't know today all the different nations that God was promising through the different kings that God made through Abraham to Isaac and how that panned out, we don't know. We can speculate. We know Israel was created, but then Israel was broken apart and scattered. What all happened to them? You're rolling dice and guessing, or you're making arguments about your speculation. So I don't know how that turn works out. So to say that Ishmael is the Muslim nations, that's an incorrect assessment. It's incorrect. That's a jump to a conclusion. It could be dead right. I don't know. But it's a jumping to a conclusion of what we perceive. Now, God still promised them a few great blessings throughout their history. Note, the promise did not include extinction or termination or getting rid of. So God has intended them to be greatly blessed to increase as well throughout their existence as a people. And they will always be that. Whatever that is, what it looks like, we're guessing and interpreting, okay? So it's difficult to say it is a particular group of peoples. I do realize that there are obviously some similarities to where the peoples end up living today, living then to what those nations look like today. And you can debate what those are. If you want to be a strict purist, you can say, well, if you look at the Middle East, all different lines, the map that carve out countries are arbitrary lines. people can live on one side of the line versus the other side of the line, the same people. If you look at the, back, you know, 125 years ago, thereabouts, turn of this first century, or last century, I mean, or the one before that, it's when a lot of those lines were created on maps, and those nations were created. Before that, they didn't look like that. Totally unrelated to that. The map lines didn't mean anything, is what they do now. So you can always debate and argue and point fingers at stuff, but it's really, really hard to actually say it's this or it's that. Fair enough? Okay. Yes.
Islam, they trace their lineage from Ishmael.
Not Islam doesn't. The nations, the Arab nations do. If you look in Islam, it's a highly racist culture. There is a superior race in Islam called the Arab. And then there is the sub-races they have broken apart. There's a reason why American slavery got a lot of its cues from the Islamic way of doing slavery. So you have race groups by law divided within Islam's religion, that certain races are not allowed to be in certain categories. And the Arab has the dominant race amongst. So if an Arab walks into a room, it's like the old American in the 1940s and 50s. You have a white guy walk in the room while the black people have to move aside. Same principle. Islam still maintains that with the Arab race. Now, within that race, you obviously have the Persian group and you have the non-Persian group, and they have their own debates on who's superior. It's a highly racist-based group, based religious structure. You can debate whether it's right or wrong. I have no control over that. This is how it's built. So in the Arab world, there's an Arab groups, and then, of course, we have the subgroups, all the Kurdistans and the this and the that, and all the various other subgroups, so the small families. But if converts, however, are one of the lowest categories inside the religion. One of, not the only. Anyway, that was a totally off topic. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Different topic. Do you know what the difference between Abram and Abraham and Sarai and Sarah? Why he changed their name? What do they mean?
Avram means my father is an Aramite. So Aramean, for example. So later on, we learn, and God's instructions for the first fruits are brought in. You have a repetition of a site. Things you have to list out. So my father was a wandering Aramean, referring to Abraham, a wandering Aramean. Abram means a father. My father is Aram. So I am like, I am the father of Aram, but my father is Aram. I'm from the tribe of the nation of Aram. Avraham is a different contraction that was broken up inside there. Avraham is still father, but it comes from the Hebrew word Haram, which is a nation or a group of people. It's a different term. So even though in English we just say it was Avram, he put a ham at the end. Well, it's not the same word. And that one is a contraction in Aramean words, and one's a contraction to Hebrew phrase. Two different contractions, they look very similar to us in our right, in how we write things. So one of is father of nations, and what's father is, or father from Aram, nation of Aram, which is where you're from, Ur of Chaldean, that is Aram's territory. That's where it's, that's Aram, an Aramean group. That's how his name is broken apart in that contraction form. Sarai, I forgot what Sarai means, honestly. I didn't think I'll even look that up. I should have. I've looked it up last year, and I've forgotten it off the top of my head, so I apologize. Sarai and Sarah. One is it's princess, and I forgot what the other one was. Sarah's princess. I forgot what Sarai means. Anybody remember what Sarai means? I've looked it up last year, and I've forgotten what Sarai means. Anybody remember that?
My princess.
My princess. It's very, very similar. So there's two different... Her name was changed to mean that. And actually, we'll explain that a little bit later, because that's a very fundamental point in what's being taking place with Pharaoh and them. Yes.
Yeah, just to go back to the prejudice in the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. I have a pretty good friend of mine. He's a Muslim. And he a number of times went to Mecca, which is one of the pillars of Islam.
Right.
And he said they treated him like, well, I don't want to say the way he said it, but it was like garbage, trash. Yeah. He is from Bangladesh. And they were just...
Wrong racial group.
Absolutely,
right.
Yeah.
Wrong, yeah. It's we don't talk about that topic in our culture because of racism and such with respect to how it manifests itself in other cultures because we focus on our own and have our heads bowed dead in shame. Exactly. So they look upon our own culture as shameful, but it's completely permissive and more than permissive, it's almost encouraged in some other non-European based cultures. It's pretty prevalent, I should say, in other cultures that are not European based. African based cultures, it's heavily prevalent, and of course, Middle Eastern culture heavily prevalent, and in Asian cultures, heavy prevalence there too. So racism is very, very strong. It's a European culture that it's shamed upon. We don't do that. And if you look at it, the Torah does not support that. Meaning the Torah supports the European philosophy of you cannot look upon someone and say, well, you're the wrong race, therefore I can look down upon you. God said, wait a minute. One law, one people. It doesn't matter if I join for any reason. Once I join, he points out, there is no difference anymore. And Ezekiel points out, even the inheritance is equal. That's profound. The inheritance, even you are what God purchased us the land. Guess what? If you want to join somebody, you adopt in that tribe, you get the same inheritance they get. So God makes a dead equal playing field regardless of where you came from, which is very impressive. Yes.
But it is after the fourth generation.
It depends on who it is.
Conversion.
Now, in Ezekiel, it says if you threw your, it's presuming, Ezekiel gives you the assumption the individual is already following God for some period of time, and that they're migrating with the people. Ezekiel 48-47 talks about that. Says, hey, they came with you. They're already following your God. Whatever tribe they had on, they get the same inheritance. Ezekiel gives that. It assumes they've already been converted. Years or prior makes a difference. But he points out the biology has vanished, just gotten rid of, which is important to know. Our God is very unique in that way. Yes, Jeff.
And that's one of the key things that the Apostle Paul was trying to get across when he was talking to folk about breaking down this distinction that had crept back in by saying, hey, you know, there's no Jew nor Greek, male nor female.
Right.
You got to remember that that's not the way the Torah or the prophets taught that this was the way it was going
to
be.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that. I do realize that we have the stories run across, oh, these people wiped out, the Amalekites killed them off, or Midianites. That is not a race problem. That is a behavior problem. So if people behaved a particular way, God said, okay, this is not fixable in our normal means. You must exterminate them because the fixing would kill them as well. So both methods, whether God kills them off, like Sodom and Gomorrah, or humans kill them off in a war, says this group or this philosophy taught us so prevalent, so ingrained, it's not fixable by we'll just slap around a bit. No, you actually have to end their existence, so the philosophy is terminated there at that group or that people. And that you run across those two, but it's not due to a race issue, it's a behavior problem within the people themselves. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, and especially when you talk about the dealing with a behavior problem, because he's saying that there are some behaviors that are even worse than Sodom and Gomorrah, because
right.
They're talking about, hey, you know, it'll be worse for them in the judgment than for Sodom and Gomorrah.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a trustworthy point that Moses pointed out. We had read it, the tail end of Deuteronomy previously, that you have two ways of living. It's not that only you get two ways. No, everybody gets two ways of living. You choose one way or you choose the other. And Moses pointed out that this is about your behavior. This is how you act and conduct yourself. Everything is. And not your background, not who your daddy was or great-great-grand, whatever. It's how you behave. And it's really important to remember that. It's always about how you behave. That's what God's matters. That's what matters to him, how you behave. Yes.
Yeah, so maybe you can respond to this. Somewhere in the back of my head, I forget what prophet it is, that said that, or the idea is that the issue of homosexuality in Sodom and Gomorrah is a false issue. It's not that. Somewhere in the prophet said, here's what the problem of Sodom and Gomorrah was. And they said it wasn't, they didn't mention homosexuality.
Right. If you argue as a human being, say, hey, well, Sodom and Gomorrah was homosexual behavior. Wait a minute. What about Greece? What about Rome? The Romans. What about the vast majority of other cultures? How come God didn't say, well, smack them down too? They're far worse. It's not about a particular behavior. It's not a singular behavior. It is a group of a mentality of people that this is so corrupt, as a whole, cannot be fixed. Hence, we have Noah and the flood, same principle. God's okay, the corruption is so severe and so prevalent, you can't just teach it out of them. You actually have to start over again. So in the case of Sodom and Gomorrah, you have to start over again. In the case of the flood, start over again. In the case of Greece, no, we can teach that out of you. That's interesting, isn't it? Because in Greek, we learn about, from Apostle Paul points out, hey, some of you guys are homosexuals with all these weird things you passed, and you have learned that that's wrong unless you stop doing it. See, you can teach that out of someone. So Sodom and Gomorrah's issue was just homosexuality. Well, you can teach it out of them, because clearly Paul points that out. You can just teach them out of it, and it's done. It's fixable. So if you can teach something out, God obviously promotes teach it out of them. And they fix their behavior. So when God's coming across them, he's like, this group you have to exterminate. It's worse than that. It's not teachable out of it. You can't just fix them in an instruction or behavior. Hey, guide them along. It's not guidable. That's a judgment that I can't make. Neither can anybody else. God's the one who can make those judgments, and he knows what's inside the person's heart and mind. If they are willing to learn or absolutely not. And not just an individual, but a whole group of people or a nation or cities. Okay? Make sense? So I don't recall exact phraseologies regarding Sodom and Gomorrah in particular, but as far as different prophets regarding them. But there are behaviors which God points out can be taught and can be fixed. The behaviors which God clearly gives examples can't be. I'm not going to say which all those behaviors are. I don't remember. I'd have to research to find out everything about all the different examples of it. Any comments or questions? Okay, we have a few things to rattle off to you. So, Lech Lecha. Obviously, we've covered Abram in this story, Abraham, as far as how he goes through this process for a number of years now. There's a few things I want to rattle off to you a couple of times, and I think I might get around to be able to rock your boat a little bit later. We'll see if I get to that point. It's fun to play with words and play with how things are written. But we'll see. I may not get to it, so if it doesn't, well. First of all, note, Abraham is being called, and although we didn't read Noah this past previous week because we weren't here, Terah and Abram's brother Haran and Nahor and Abram himself, of course, they left Ur of the Chaldeans and moved on. Now, Haran, his brother, died in Ur of the Chaldeans, but I know they sound the same, they're not. But the town of Haran is where they dwelt. It's in English, it's the H. It's actually, one's a Het and one's a the He. So they sound the same, but they're not the same. So they went to a town and they stayed there. Now recall the tradition, of course, is that Haran, Abram's brother, died saving Abram. It's just a Jewish tradition, a Jewish made-up story. I don't think this is a true or even fair to assess that, because you're just guessing, because it's truly, strictly a guess. Either way, he died, but Abram took a hold of her or bonded himself with Lot. So they went together as a team. Hence, where that made-up story comes from is why was Abram so attached to his nephew? They're just guessing that maybe that somehow he felt responsible. Yeah, whatever. It doesn't matter. Either way, both men stuck together. You can debate what the reasons are. I, my personal belief, God called them both out. That's my personal opinion. I mean, he wanted them both to stay together. That's just my opinion, though. You don't have to agree with me. What I find interesting is that when you have to move, any one of you, I got to move from here, I got to move. What's the first thing you think about? Where am I going to go? Move to. I'm going to move. Move to where? next door, next state, other side of the world. Where am I moving to? Where's the destination? Was Abram given a destination? No. So when God says move and you pack up, okay, God. Do I walk? Is it a short distance? If I take an airplane, a car ride? What are we talking here? Just hit the gas pedal and see where it ends up? I don't know. So you run out of gas? Abram, it is a strange place to be when you don't know where you're going. You just know you came from that direction, so I'm going to keep heading that way until God says, stop, you found it. So that's where Abram essentially did. He traveled, of course, made to Canaan, and God says, stop. Oh, this is the spot. Got it. Okay, this is where he said stop, so I'm stopping. It's not a very comfortable place for us to be, because obviously we like to know where we're going first, but in this case, Abram didn't have that luxury, so he just went. I want to point out some details to you. Of course, he stopped near Shechem, as it points out in verse 7-8, end of chapter 12. And then he builds an altar there in Shechem. Now, mind you, Abram grew up and was trained in idol worship. Idol worshiper. His dad was an idol worshiper. Not the tradition of idol maker. That's a Jewish tradition. But his dad, Terah, was an idol worshiper. So were Abram's brothers. They said they're all idol worshipers. That's what they know. That's understand. So I have a question for you. Let's pretend... Imagine yourself in Abram's philosophy, Abram's position. You may know of, I'm making up a number, 15 different gods that you're supposed to pray to every day. Just make it up. It could be 20, it could be 5, I don't care. Just make up a number. And you hear one saying, go this way. Which one was it?
Yeah.
Was it the one with the long nose or the short ears? Or was it the one?
Spoke the
which one's the louder? So does Abram know much about this God that spoke to him? Now, mind you, he was trained and born and trained in idol worship, much like his father was. As Joshua, the book of Joshua tells us that he didn't know much about this God.
I don't know
how God spoke to him. Now, God tells Moses, "I talk to you face to face, but all others speak in dreams and visions." So, most likely, Abraham later on. Most likely, since God told Moses that, then Abraham, God probably spoke to him also in visions and dreams, not necessarily like a conversational, you know, like you and I have a conversation. Because God said to Moses, you and I have conversations.
But did he tell him that he
threw him
on the floor, remember
that? That's a story. The whole... No, that's not in the Bible. So the story, the Jewish tradition specifies that Terah was an idol maker.
Right.
Now, that's not in the Bible. Terah was an idol worshiper, not a maker. He could have been one. We don't know what different living. No, it's not in the Bible. The story about Abram knocking down all the idols and breaking them, that's not in the Bible. No, that's a made up midrash. It's a story. This is a child's story. And it sounds strange, but that's what it is. Yes.
Have a book about the when he knocked on the idols.
Right, and it's a child's story. Right, it's a child. It's a story. It's not a textual scripture. Anyhow, yes.
There's also a story about him watching the moon come up and go down, and the sun come up and go down, and decided there must be something greater than the moon and the sun because both of those got canceled out when they went down.
It's also a made up story.
Yeah.
So we don't know. Be honest with you, okay? Think about yourself, right? Your own person. Yeah, yes, I'm sure. Think about your own personal life. How many stories do you know? Do you remember from childhood? Just stories your parents told you or somebody else. Just a story, but you didn't write it down. Couldn't write then. But were they important? They're just stories. Not history. No, just stories. So is it possible any of those things could have happened? Of course. Now, since all those stories were only fashioned about 1,000 years after Abraham, 1,500 years after Abraham was dead, it's really hard to say what was true. Imagine for a moment, go back in your mind, 1,500 years ago from today. Good luck. What stories are real and what stories were made up?
King Arthur.
King Arthur, right? Was that, well, we don't really know what was real. Did the man exist? Probably. Was he, who knows about him? They're made up stories. So how accurate is that 1,500-year-old story today? Who knows? Flip a coin. It could be anything, right? Well, so all 1,500-year-old stories are not going to be very accurate. So Abraham, who dies, and then 1,500 years later, they come up with a story of how this all happened. 1,500 years later, can you hold him to him? No, they're just stories. So try not to confuse the stories with what's actual record, all right? I'm not saying the stories are false. Just point out the stories. They could be right, could be wrong. Who cares? They're just stories. But the stories were designed, as you read those stories, paint those little stories, they're moral, principled stories. They're supposed to teach a child something. That's, you can tell the story, it's supposed to teach you something. That's how you know it's a story. It's a principle story. It could be a true story, doesn't matter. It's supposed to teach you something, it's a story, as opposed to just fact. Facts are facts. They don't teach anything, just there's facts. Tammy.
That's something to think about with the parable of Lazarus and the rich man and Lazarus.
It's a parable. It's a story.
It's a story to make a point. But it's not the point about what happens when one dies. The right. Punchline at the end is the point, not this narrative, oh yeah, people go to hell when they die or they go to mm-hmm. heaven right when they die. That wasn't his point. That wasn't the point of that lesson.
Right.
So we have to be really careful when we read any stories to ascertain if someone's trying to teach us history or if they're trying to make a different point.
Exactly. Most of the parables Messiah points out, they aren't necessarily like demonstrable things. The whole build his house upon a sand and a rock, okay? You go, oh, well, he's telling a true story of these two men. One's Bob, one's Fred. No, they're made up stories. Like the three little pigs, it's a made up story. It's not, pigs don't actually build houses. It's a made up. We know that. So it's a story of an example of what can happen to understand what you're basing your life on and what you're building on. It's a story. And now the story is right or wrong. It's just a story. Okay, I'm totally off topic. Let's move forward because I didn't mean to stick on that. So we don't know much about Abram except that he was born and raised and taught to worship idols, but like his dad was taught and did worship idols, as Joshua points out to us, the book of Joshua, as well as Abram's brothers. So there's his family tradition of a particular way of life, and is one of many idols or one of many gods, and which one it is, calls him to go do something. Now here's where tradition mixes up with right and wrong. How responsible are you or I to understand our God, to know when he's speaking to us versus when something evil is speaking to us? That's a key question. Because if Abram, born and raised worshiping many idols, any one of them could have a demonic influence within inside of it. And if you're, as God pointed out to Moses, God said, I speak to others in visions and dreams, not actual conversations. So if I have a vision or a dream, now we know if the Torah says you challenge it. Your vision or dream, you challenge it. Is this from you? Prove it. Find out if it's from God or from something else. So if Abram's going to follow this, whatever deity it is, he may not understand it yet, and we find out later he has to learn a lot, but he gets there. What's Abram's probably going to do? Now, mind you, don't forget, we learn later, God is pleased with Abraham's personal viewpoint in life at how teaching his children what is right and what is wrong continuously. So God likes the style of Abraham's mental state of being and how what he thinks is important, what's not important. So having that mental state and belief within inside the man, Abram, or Abraham, that God knows that within inside him, he knows what is right inherently, what is wrong inherently, and how to teach it. So that's Abraham's character trait. With that character trait of a man, when God speaks to Abraham, says, walk, go somewhere, wherever it is, though the Bible doesn't tell us what Abraham asked or what Abraham said, what would you do? Well, your job is to challenge it. Is this from you, God, or not? So what do you think Abram did? Most likely he asked, who are you? Challenge it. Is this from you or not? Because that's what we're taught to do. So it makes sense he's probably taught similarly or has a similar idea behind it. It's my opinion that he probably asked, Who are you? What are you? What is this character? What is this, this vision that I'm seeing? Explain this to me or give me some kind of verification. That's my opinion, because that's what our job is. You start hearing voices, whether in a dream or a vision, challenge them first. Don't just obey and accept. You know, what's that, the serial killers who pop up and the crazy people, right? Who don't challenge, just follow suit. Don't do that. You challenge and ask, find out. God does not take that as necessarily an angry insult. He taught us to do it. But what about the other people who have challenged? Remember the John Baptist's dad? He challenged and God said, don't speak. Well, yeah. That's not a bad thing. That's a miracle. What did it do? Evan Adams said, what happened? God did something to you. His ability to not speak was actually a blessing to those around him. They goes, wait a minute, God did something to you, and they all started to fear God more. So that's a good thing. Even though it may seem bad, it's not necessarily bad to challenge and ask, wait a minute, is this real or not? Somebody hand up. Yes, Anne.
My question is, at some point along the way here, it says that Abraham called on the name of the Lord.
Yes, did twice.
Okay, so he knew God's name.
That's what the text says.
So in the Hebrew, it would have said, called upon Adonai.
It says Jehovah. It says the name.
Jehovah.
Yeah, that's what it says. How was it? Okay, this is really difficult. I'll say that honestly, because Hebrew is written in Hebrew. It's written. So when it says, you know, it has God's name, Jehovah, written it all over the place. Because written for somebody who knows Hebrew. So what name Abraham used at that moment in time, Hebrew can't record that. It doesn't know it. All it knows is that there's one God that it understands, and God already gave us his name. So you're looking at a text that's written by someone or some people, group people, most likely Moses, after they already knew what God's name really was. So they would insert the name in there. Abraham could have said, hey, God named Bob. We don't know what he called him, or Fred, or Jimmy Joe. We don't know what he is. It makes no difference. Because a Hebrew author is going to write down what he understands as the name of Jehovah, written there, the Yod, He, Vav, He, the four letters. So we don't know what word or what this Abraham used. It doesn't matter, because in our text, it's only going to write down an after-the-fact point using God's name and insert it in the place. Does that make sense? Hopefully it makes sense.
How would he know how to make an altar? I mean, you know.
That's the next question. When I brought up the question earlier about the whole, all the different idols he would have been taught up to raise to worship as a kid, growing up and going up to, he's a grown up man now. The altar idea, making an altar. Most likely he had experience of either worshiping at altars of idols or having done so as a child or even going as a grown up adult, we don't know. So that altar, the way of worshiping a god at an altar is probably fairly strong or fairly common in that world. If you recall, though we didn't read it because we weren't here last week, Noah makes an altar as well after the flood. So the idea of an altar is not a foreign concept, but it would, and since Abraham, of course, descended to Noah, which, of course, all men are, all mankind is, but he would have probably had an idea of what an altar looked like or what it was supposed to be. Now, we could debate what it looked like then, but we can't say for certain. Yes.
You know, they had each tribe had a staff, and in the staff was a story. So they would carve their in the staff. Maybe they had, you know, the photographs and things were in there. So that's how, because they hadn't down the stories one generation to the next. They didn't have television, but they held to their stories. They were, I don't know if they call them folklore, but that was like one of the most important things that you would send down to the generation of children, is that they weren't necessarily always just stories, but they did have that, their history in the staff.
Probably some degree. I imagine some genealogy would have written there, like who begat who, like a history of names. I don't know how much you could write down. I don't know. I haven't carved. I don't know. I wouldn't know. I've never carved like that. Who knows? I tend to agree with my personal opinion with Patterns Evidence Guy. I can't think what he said about the creation of language and how that was created, Because once language is written down and created as a text written out thing, then story can be preserved in the log of our memory. As you'll note when you're reading through Genesis, it's very, very light on the actual facts and stories of lives. It's just kind of it skims a lot. It's very like overall broad brush, just facts going through with a few snippets of here and there. Until you show up in Genesis around Joseph's time, the stories get long and drawn out. So no, things were written down sometime near the time of Jacob and Joseph, that time, which because stories can go from compact and short to long and detailed and broad. So that comes from not telling stories. That comes from writing stories. I'm not sure. You can debate as far as who learned what language, but when language is converted from pictorial, like notes, to actual written out stories, you can see it in history as they go from basic so-and-so begat so-and-so kind of thing in the Bible versus now let's say the guy's story from beginning to end, from his life, all what other thing he did. Now, you know that's a written down story, not a passed on verbally or traditional passed on story. It's pretty common in not just a biblical culture, but in all cultures are written up that way. When language is developed, you see stories going from basic notes to massive long stories, long history. Okay? Anyway, let's move forward. Because I don't want to stay here, and I'm staying here too long. I want to talk about something that's more interesting. Move on. Let's go. Okay. I'm going to skip a few things because we've talked about them in the past. There's one thing I want to point out to you, which is very interesting. To me, which I mentioned this before, I'll mention it again because you don't forget. It's going to pop up. The two things I want to talk about to you today that are not related to what we've discussed so far. The first thing I want to discuss, which I'm not going to draw this out, but I'll just point it out to you because you can look it up yourself. It's really easy. From verse 12, markers. I should use a better marker. Where's a better marker? Chapter 12. Verse 8 through 13, verse 4. It has bookends built in, which is the chiasm structure. It's the whole you start out because it's earlier the start. You start at Bethel. He mentions by the name of God. Goes to the story about going down to Pharaoh. Comes back out again. He returns to Bethel. Lists the name of God. So you have a bookends. So inside this bookend structure from this to that verse, verse 12 through verse 4 of 13, there is a structure built inside the story, trying to tell you a lesson and highlight a point. If you look inside the story, if you're matching from story to story, if they narrow down to the middle of the story, there's a particular phrase or terminology being rattled off there. And that comes up in from verse somewhere around. It's a verse 15, 16, and the first part of verse 17 is the middle of this structured story that's condensed story. So the purpose of the story is to tell you verse 15, 16, and part of verse 17. So the purpose of that section for him going to Pharaoh was this. When the officials of Pharaoh saw her, they lauded her for Pharaoh. The woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. He treated Abram well for her sake. He acquired sheep, cattle, donkeys, slaves, maidservants, female donkeys, and camels. But Jehovah afflicted Pharaoh along with his household. That's the center of this structure, this chiastic structure, which we've talked about in the past. That means the purpose of the verse 8 through 13:4 is to tell you that detail. You have to ask yourselves, why? Who cares? So she was pretty. You're in the house. There's a pattern. Abram got a bunch of stuff. And then God struck Pharaoh, or struck his household. Now, let me rephrase that one more time. In different words, she was desirable. She was taken to Pharaoh's house in his ownership, possession. Abram received a bunch of stuff from Egypt. Pharaoh's household was struck with plagues, and Pharaoh's household escorted them out. Now, one more time, different words. A people were taken into Pharaoh's household, oppressed under Pharaoh. Because, mind you, when you are owned by someone, are you free? No. As long as Sarah is in Pharaoh's household, is she free? No. It's a foreshadow of the Exodus. What's going on here appears to be a foreshadow of the Exodus. Pharaoh winds up escorting through a high hand, yelling them, get out of my land. And guess what? They plundered Egypt. So what was Abram doing?
Oh, wow.
He was plundering Egypt in a small scale.
Yeah, wow.
What was going to happen? So what's happening, the story appears to be, though it's not a dead ringer for perfectness, but what did Pharaoh have during the Exodus? So he had a whole bunch of slaves. Was that desirable to have? Yes, in case you weren't, no. Yes, yes, it is a desire to have slaves. So lots of slaves he liked. They were very desirable to him. They were under his control and ownership, much like Sarah is under his control and ownership, even though he's not, didn't, you know her, the sort of like have a sexual relations, but still was under his ownership. The same principle. And what are we learning from this? Well, in this story, if we did these comparisons, we would see that, okay, it appears that God was utilizing this story that Abram and Sarai are going through at this time. He reutilizes it again in the story of the Exodus. I have a follow-up question then, which we have, it's not part of this Torah portion. If that was in fact a foreshadow of the Exodus, note, Abraham later on, and Sarah do the same thing again later on to the Philistine commander, or Philistine king. Now, if the story of the Exodus is foreshadowed in this story of Pharaoh, then what do you think might be the foreshadow occurring with the Philistine king? Now, the Philistine king, a few things are different. Number one, they're not driven out. But Abraham, of course, winds up explaining, hey, she's my half-sister. All right, the detail there. But what do Philistines represent in our Tanakh? No, giants are giants. What do Philistines represent? What kind of person are they categorized? They are uncircumcised Gentiles. Crude individuals. So if I was going to argue, I am arguing about the Pharaoh, is that this foreshadowing with Abraham and Pharaoh and Sarai, it's not Abraham yet, but she's still called Sarai, he's still called Abram. That if that's a foreshadow of the Exodus, the other event might be a foreshadow of something else that's similar. Well, one of the things that we are anticipating is God pulling his people out of all the nations.
Yes, a greater exodus,
right? We're anticipating that. So my opinion, since one seems to foreshadow the Exodus, the other one may foreshadow what we're still waiting for. The pulling out of not of Egypt, but rather the other nations, which what Philistines represent, the uncouth, gross nations, the other people, the people who follow God. Pulling out, to highlight, to pull out, because they're desirable to leave, to flee. That's my opinion only, but it's just, it's an interesting point, because it's a possibility. Yes, Sharon.
Come?
That would imply yet to come, because they have not come out of those nations yet. No, not a rapture. No, I'm not a rapture. It's calling out of nations. As it points out in the prophecy, that God will call people from the ends of the earth and return them to Israel. Return them. That's my opinion, of course. It's my opinion. It's an opinion.
Right now, today. He's calling them out of every nation today. I mean, you see all the time Arabs and Chinese and, you know, are coming to Christ. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he may not physically be taking them out.
And we don't know what it looks like yet.
But he's calling them out and drawing him towards himself.
It very well be. Because we don't get the physical calling out story until we get from Isaac. So when Isaac does with Rebecca, that's the physical driving them out. So the same thing happens again with Isaac's story. But in Isaac's story, we get the additional information that they're actually driven out of the nations, get out of here, and leave. So we had there's a twofold thing going on there. So if it's a big if Abraham, Sarai, and Pharaoh's story is a foreshadow of Egyptian Exodus, it is possible the story of Abraham, Sarah, and the Philistine king, as well as Isaac, Rebekah, and the Philistine king, may be something that is a future event of a pulling out. It's just my opinion. Just throw it out there because it's something. It's an interesting thought. Yes, Anne.
When you say Philistine king, do you mean Abimelech?
Yes.
Or who? Okay.
Yes, Philistine king Abimelech. They're both named Abimelech, both with Abraham and Sarai, as well as with Isaac and Rebekah. But since those events occur like 60 or 70 years apart from each other, it's probably not the same guy. It's most likely another guy named Abimelech, same name, but different character. The pharaohs, sometimes we use names, but sometimes it varied. Kings in the Bible, you'll notice they reuse the names a lot. All right, but that's not what I want to talk about. That's just an interesting side note. What I want to do is to have 15 minutes. I get to do this, so I'm going to do it. I get to throw a monkey wrench into your thoughts. So we are Christian by nature, right? So we understand there's certain details that Christians understand or are taught and think. And we think things because we're trained to think that way and we're taught to think that way. So we think it that way. And when we read something, we interpret it a particular way because it's how we are trained to read things. Now, mind you, when you interpret it from a Christian, I'll use the term loosely, Christian / Greek way of thinking, you come with a particular conclusion from a story. If, however, you read it from a Christian / Jewish thinking, come with a slightly different story, different interpretation, different ending to the story. If you read it from a strictly Jewish perspective, not Christian, not Greek, you come with a third different variation or conclusion of the story. So there's one thing I want to read to you because there's a really, really good chance most of you read this one way because we're taught to read it one way. And there's another possibility that it can teach you a different lesson if you do it from a different perspective. So jump to the story of Melchizedek. I'm not changing anything in your textual Bibles. Nothing. I'm not making any alterations. Nothing whatsoever. The text is the same words every time. It is what you and I interpret the text to mean, and the words it says changes what it means to us. All right. So the story of Melchizedek. So we have. Let's see. This is a verse. Jump down to. Was it? It's 14. Where is it? There it is. So chapter 14. Yeah, chapter 14. But I read this to you, and I'm going to pause periodically and ask you what you think is going on. So who's who in the story? Start jumping down to chapter 14. We're starting in verse 16. Okay, starting in verse 16. Now we're jumping in the middle of the story of him. He's coming back for the kings. He brought back all the possessions. He also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, as well as women and the people. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from defeating Chedorlaomer, and the kings that were with him to the valley of Shavet, which is the king's valley. But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God, the Most High. He blessed him, saying, "Blesses Abram of God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. And blessed be God, the Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand." And he gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and take the possessions back for yourself." Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I lift up my hand to Jehovah, God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. If so much as a thread to a shoot strap, or if I shall take anything from yours, you shall not say it is I who made Abram rich. Far be it from me." I'm going to stop there for a minute. Now, you know the story. You've read it probably a gazillion times. Now, I'm going to ask you questions. I'm going to read a few phrases. I'm going to ask you questions periodically. This is the question I'm going to ask you. Jump back to verse 18. But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He, who's he? Melchizedek, okay. He was a priest of God, the Most High. He, who's he? Blessed him, saying, blessed is Abram of God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God, the Most High, who has delivered your, who's the your? Abram, foes into your hand, and he, who's he? Gave him, who's him? A tenth of everything. You notice what you just pointed out? You don't know the he and the him. You have assumed, and I have assumed, and people have assumed, and Christianity has assumed for 2,000 plus years, and even Judaism has many times as well, assumed for 2,300 years, who the he and the him are. Right. Now, the New Testament in the book of Hebrews is teaching us a metaphorical simile. Simile? Yeah, it's a metaphorical story about the concept of a priesthood existing parallel or independent of the Levitical priesthood. Hebrews is telling us about these priesthood concepts, how that there could be two parallel priesthoods and how this process is supposed to work. So we have a structure. Hebrews is arguing an opinion about an example of a structure, but if you read this strictly in a Hebrew text and doesn't say who the he and who the him are, the story goes like this, if you were just staying true to the concept, the story sequence, it would say the last half of verse 20 says, and he, Melchizedek, gave him, Abraham, a tenth of everything. That's how you would read it in traditional standard Jewish Hebrew text. That's how you would normally read it. That's how anybody would normally read it, because that's how it's normally written. It doesn't give the identity of who, because mind you, I say that because the word he, in multiple times with the whole section, always refers to the exact same man, as you already said, pointed out yourself. You said, who's the he? Well, it's Melchizedek. Who's the he? Melchizedek. Who's the he? Melchizedek. It was always the same thing as he. You know it, and I know it. Well, it's clear it's Melchizedek. There's nothing in the text to tell you it changed. We, as Christians, reading Hebrews, made the assumption, oh, we'll flip it. It must not be, it can't be what it looks like because we have a philosophy taught to us that only priests can receive a tenth. And of course, one's a priest, therefore he must read the tenth. But if you're reading the Hebrew text, just the text alone, it teaches something different. Not to say that switching is right or wrong. I'm not arguing that. That's ridiculous. You can't prove one way or the other. But if you read it, the Hebrew text teaches something that's a profound difference in what's being taught to us. If you read a Hebrew text, and just as traditional readings, meaning traditional Hebrew reading, you would learn a different lesson than what's being taught in the Christian reading or the modern or rabbinical reading of it. Does it make sense? The lessons being taught in a strictly Hebrew reading of it, without putting a rabbinical spin, Christian spin, or a Greek spin on it, just text alone, we're making a comparison between Melchizedek and Sodom, the king of Sodom. The Hebrew reading just makes those comparisons, which teaches something that the Christianity has been teaching us for decades, and you teach it for decades. It's a different lesson, but it's something very unique, which we'll read about. Yes?
Hebrew doesn't have a genitive case then, right?
Not in that case. No, it does not. Not in this.
That's how we get it in Greek. We would know which one it came from because of the genitive case.
Correct. And this does not have that. So if we don't have that, we make an assumption on it. It's the same problem that occurs back, I forget the prophet's name off the top of my head. Mom, you might remember this. When it condemns the king of Moab for burning his son king of Edom's son on the wall. Well, if you read the text in the story when it happened, it sounds like Moab burned his own son on the wall. No, it was King of Edom's son he was burning on the wall. Well, because the text doesn't tell you who's who when the events were being recorded as the human sacrifice he was doing, it doesn't tell you. We assume it is Moab's, the king of Moab is burning his own son. But he's not. The prophets later point out, no. Because we made this assumption, our assumption was wrong. Prophets put out, and God condemns this. He wasn't burning his own son. He was killing the king of Edom's son, burning him on the wall. It's wrong either way, but it's two different people being murdered, being killed, and we misunderstand it. Because it's two different lessons being taught. If you assume one, you learn a particular lesson. If you learn the other one, you learn a second independent lesson. Both lessons are true. But they're two different lessons, right? So you can learn the lesson either way. That's what's beautiful about the text. It's a living text, it's true. So in this case, when we learn this, if we just read it in the Hebrew text, we have a lesson. Where did my green marker go? I'll use an orange one. We learn something different. So in this case, we have a comparison, which is a Hebrew text alone, not the Christian variation or the rabbinical variation, just Hebrew text alone. You learn a lesson that God teaches within the text. So he teaches the he and the him, right? So we are comparing King of Sodom and the King of Salem or Jerusalem. We're comparing these two kings and their personal behaviors and how Abraham treats one versus the other. Now, mind you, in this story, if we understand Abraham fairly well, he's a messianic style figure. So he teaches us a concept of deliverance, a concept of trusting or listening to our God at all costs. That's the kind of character he is. So if we look at the Hebrew text alone and not interpret the words, we learn this. King of Salem offered Abraham the tenth, to Abraham, and Abraham accepted it. King of Sodom tried to outdo him by offering everything except the people. So Sodom's giving pretty much 100%. What did Abraham treat him as? I won't take even a shoe or sandal strap. Take nothing from you. So what does that teach us about the characters of these two kings? If we read the text in just the text alone, what's the character of the king of Salem? What's the character of the king of Sodom? Well, they're both generous. Right, one's wicked. So, I have a question for you. Now put yourself in the shoes of the king of Sodom. And you're talking to God, the creator of heaven and earth. Now you're a wicked individual. Say, okay, God, I can't fix my past, but I'll just give you more. Does God accept it? No. You can't bribe God. So can you bribe Abraham? No. It doesn't matter how bad or how good you are, you can't bribe. So this is what I think is beautiful about the text. It matches the Torah's instructions. No matter how bad you are or how good you are, doesn't affect what God will accept from you regarding what he amounts. So God says you only give a tenth. So if I'm a semi-righteous person, and Micah here is a semi-more righteous person. So I say, okay, God, Micah's better than me. I'm going to give you 20% of my tithe. Ha! I'll do that, Micah. What did I just do? I'm trying to bribe God. Now, would God be happy with me, happier than he would with Micah? No, I wouldn't be. Now, this is a fundamental belief we have to understand about what God's teaching Abraham, because we learn with the offering of Isaac, that God is accepting only what he says you will give. Right. Giving more does not gain favor. Right. It doesn't. It doesn't give us favor with God. So we're learning in these two kings, if we use these two, just the text itself, being righteous, the tenth is sufficient. Being unrighteous, 100%, isn't even sufficient. So even if you're unrighteous, no matter how much you give, doesn't fix unrighteousness. Now, being righteous, giving nothing, isn't an acceptable behavior either. As the king of Salem gives, he still gives the 10%, even though he's a righteous king, a righteous priest of God Most High. So the lesson, if we read it just in the Hebrew text alone, teaches us this about the two kings, and this about the two behaviors. You can't pay your way out of your sins. That's the lesson it teaches us if a strictly Hebrew text alone. That's a good lesson to learn, isn't it? Is it true? Yes. You can't pay yourself out of your way your sins. It doesn't, no matter how much you pay, it doesn't fix who you are and what you do. Hence, we talked about earlier when God says this group of people cannot be taught there to fix them. I will remove them from existence instead, as if God, Sodom and Gomorrah does that. When you learn that's how God does it. When your behavior is so far that even if you gave 100% of everything you had, still couldn't fix it, you can't get fixed, can you? You're too far gone. So, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the Book of Hebrews analysis was incorrect. Oh, that's ridiculous. It's fine. It's perfectly fine correct as far as who gave what and tenth. It doesn't even matter. My point is, reading the text two different ways gives you two different lessons, doesn't it? It's the same words, but they're two different lessons. I can read it in a strict Hebrew text and learn a lesson of, wait a minute, righteousness outweighs all possessions I can possibly give to God. I cannot make up for my unrighteous behavior. It can't be done. Does it make sense? That teaches that part of the lesson, reading it just in this text alone, which is a good lesson to learn. It's an important lesson to learn. This is not to argue the Book of Hebrews is incorrect. That's ridiculous. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just pointing out that reading the text in two ways gives you two different correct lessons, doesn't it? That's why it's an interesting book. The book allows us to do that. We read the same words, didn't change anything. We didn't change words, nothing, didn't rearrange anything. We're just reading the same text with two different preconceived ideas, and we come with two different preconceived, with those ideas, two different conclusions as a result. Does that make sense? Any questions about that? Okay. Yes, Larry.
I'm thinking maybe this applies to Cain and Abel, because it doesn't explain why Cain's sacrifice wasn't accepted.
Right.
And Abel's was.
Right. Same principle, same lesson, same story, same idea.
I always wondered, why did he choose one or not the other?
Because no matter how much you give, if you're wicked and you cannot make up for that wickedness. Now, can Sodom, the king of Sodom, have a change of heart? Of course he can. Yeah, he clearly doesn't, but yeah. You can't give enough to make, you can't bribe it off. Right, you can bribe a man, you can't bribe God. Yes.
Well, one of the things about Cain and Abel and why Cain's offering wasn't accepted, it's actually explained in Leviticus, Psalms, and in Isaiah and some of the other ones, being that what was the heart's intent when he showed up with the offering?
Right, to bribe.
You know, and you see later on, it's like, hey, sin is crouching in your heart. Mm-hmm. You know, if you do what is right, your offering will be accepted. It's not what you bring, it's how you bring it. Mm-hmm.
And which matches the lesson we got here with Sodom and Salem. They're both the same. It's within inside the wickedness, which we're already told ahead of time the story. Sodom is exceedingly wicked. So we already know that part ahead of time before we even get to this part of the story. Yes, Deborah.
Also, God is dealing with two entities within ourselves, our two natures. We have a spirit and we have the flesh. Mm-hmm. So these lessons can be to both men because flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom of God. So these double-pronged lessons, I think, are for us in a deeper, you know, like the deeper level of thinking is that once you, God gives you this, you get the knowledge, and then, you know, you study it and you say, well, I already read the story. You can't get it. So that, you know, the longer your heart is, if you want to seek God with all your heart, you will stay in that book.
Right.
And that's when you get the mystery, the second blessing. And I think that speaks to the spirit, which that's what we're grooming for the kingdom is the spirit, because flesh and blood will not inherit it.
Right.
You can take that in there.
And it chooses the character of these two individuals. Which one, if I was going to choose King of Sodom, King of Salem, which one's likely to care about his people and pray to God and actually end up in heaven? Well, it's pretty hands down. One guy would and one guy wouldn't. One's using bribery to offset the wickedness, thinking that that's enough to make it all better, and it's not. Anne, your hand was up?
Yeah, I have 2 points. First one, where you just kind of brought it up. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people.
I'll take
it. Well, he wants to do slavery on the people.
Right.
Yeah. And then, so that was something that just came up. But the other thing is, there we are, you know, we're wondering whether the fire's going to eat our house or whatever. And we're saying, oh, Lord, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll do this. I'll be this.
I'll fix my behavior.
I'll give my body to be, you know, a living sacrifice like you ask. And, you know, we kind of do that kind of thing to keep our homes.
We do that when you're caught. When there's something wrong, what's your first instinct? It makes yourself look better. Change. First, I'll argue my opinion. Come on. I make myself look better. Shine my sin, make it nice and pretty so it doesn't look so bad. Or it's our human nature, right? The point is, what does God point out? No, it's the character inside you leading up this point that actually mattered. Not the moment of truth when it comes to judgment time. No, it's, wait a minute, what were you like all the way along? That's what matters. Hence, we have the two characters of what am I like all the way along versus, well, I was wrong before, but I'll just pay my way through. Doesn't work that way. It's two different ways of character. Anyway, I don't want to offend anybody as far as their opinion and belief regarding what the Christian text in Hebrews says. It's not about that. It's about the lesson itself, what you can learn from two different techniques, from two different kings, and how they treated Abraham's blessing, if you read it in this particular way. That's what I was after. Teshuva, to return.
To return.
Yeah. Any questions or comments regarding this portion? I gotta call. I know I'm way over time. I apologize for that. But I was debating whether to cover this particular section or not in this way because I didn't do it last year. I would offend people because I didn't want to offend anybody. But anyway, so I did this year because it was bothering me. Anyway. I'm out of time, so I'm going to skip the section of the cutting the covenant as well as the circumcision part. That's pretty self-explanatory. You can read it. It's the circumcision part is a forever thing, much like Shabbat, it's a forever thing. They use the same words, so it's a never-ending cycle. As long if you believe Shabbat is going to continue on, then you believe circumcision is going to continue on because they're tied. It's the same words being used, a forever thing. So just be aware that forever means forever. It doesn't mean like, well, you know, until we feel like changing it. But that's just, much like Shabbat's forever until you feel like it's being on Sunday instead. No, it doesn't work that way. You can't just flip things around. And the covenant God, there's a play on words there. There's also the story too. But the term covenant means to cut something. So the whole cutting the animals open, that's it. Covenant means to cut it, like cutting a deal. Cut a deal. Same. That's what the word covenant means. So they cut the animals open as a covenant. They cut the foreskin as a covenant. It's a cut a deal. We're making an exchange. We're making a deal. This is what the deal is. You're my God. I'm your people. I get the inheritance in this world and the world to come. That's the deal. And God says, this is a sign. You do this or not. You don't do it by choice. Guess what? Go away. You don't want my deal. I'm not going to be with you. That's how it's supposed to work. Covenants are, we argue them being one-sided. They really are semi-one-sided in that you yourself can't do God's part and God needs to help you do your part. But there still is something required of you in that covenant. I can't say, God, I'm yours, then go off and spend my own life doing whatever the heck I feel like doing. It doesn't work that way. There's still responsibility on my part to uphold my part of the deal. However best, how much successful or failure I have in it, still my job. So covenants are still a two-sided thing, not truly one-sided, that we talk about that as a one-sided thing. It's really not. It is still two-sided, even though you may need assistance on your side for your failures. That's a separate problem. Yes, Jeff.
And one of the underlying things of all contracts is trust.
Right.
And how much trust, i.e. faith, mm-hmm. there is between the two parties, going one direction, going the other direction. And if you fall out of faith, then contracts go south very fast.
They do.
And so when it's talking in this passage about, you know, and he believed God, he had trust in God in these promises, and it was credited to him as righteousness, that's kind of talking about the underlying factor of what was codified via circumcision,
right.
And that's the underlying of the other covenants too. And thus, when we're talking about Hanukkah coming up there,
dedication.
That was one of the underlying things of that crisis was, do you trust that the Lord is going to deliver the people and continue the people on, even through this crisis where you have this power saying, you know, submit
or
stop
die.
Doing what you're doing.
You have the choice.
Or we will crush you, kill you.
You no longer have a right to live. Yes. How do you do that? You know, how do you deal with that? Yes, Rose.
Well, I just had a thought about these two kings.
Mm-hmm.
that I'm this evil person. I have nothing. I have
you
nothing.
You can't even give 100%.
I have nothing to give to God
right.
to make amends for
right.
the things that I have done.
Right.
But on the other hand, that King of Salem gave me 10%. Mm-hmm. Can I take that 10% that he gave me and offer it up to God and be like behind that King of Salem? Does that make sense? You know, God.
I think about that. So if God blesses you with something, okay. So,
well, he blessed me with a savior,
right?
So that 10%.
What can you give back, so to speak?
Can I give his son back to him? I'm accepting.
Yeah.
I'm accepting that 10%. But I want to give it
back.
A few more
things.
I want to give that portion to God.
There's a few symbols there that are included in what you're talking about. I know it's a little complicated. So the symbol there is that, as I mentioned earlier, with the argument I was saying about, you know, Sarah being under Pharaoh's household, that she's no longer free. So when someone owns you, they're your owner. All right? You don't get to own yourself anymore, right? So as long as someone purchased you, and Abraham's instruction with the covenant is, anyone bought your house or purchased with your money, is this is the rule for it. This agreement in it. So in this case, when Messiah died, he purchased you with something in his life. So he's the one who owns you. Now, as a result, the covenant is attached to you because as given to Abraham, anything you own must be part of this agreement too. Messiah owns you, you have to be part of the same agreement that Abraham's in. Whether you're male or female makes no difference. He bought you, so you're part of the same deal. So as long as you're owned, you are owned. Now, when you give something, you can't give your owner back to his goods. You don't give your owner back his goods saying, here, take it from me. That doesn't work. That's a decision she has to make. So when it comes to when someone owns you, as the Torah gives this example, you have 7 years before you would say, I want to be on my own, go away. Or, no, I'm going to stay with you the rest of my life. So that's your choice. Yeah, pierce your ear, you're with the rest of life. So as long as he owns you, you made your decision, you're with the rest of life, but you have to stick with that. You can't sit there, run away like Hagar tried to do. You don't get to free yourself. God told Hagar, no. You have to go back until you're set free. Now, when was she set free? When Abraham put the stuff on her, says, now you're free. So your owner is the one who has to set you free. You don't get to free yourself. So as long as he owns you, he owns you. Now, you could be an obedient servant or a disobedient one. That's between you and him, not me. But as far as giving what is blessed, what the blessing is to you, you personally have to be blessed by his ownership. His ownership is the blessing that you're referring to. You can't give that back to him. Well, you can give to, you're a servant. So as long as you're an obedient servant, when he tells you to serve, that's your job. You serve the job. Because he is your owner. You can't fix that. You don't have the power to change that. He does. He can sell you or send you off, or he say, no, I'm going to give you more tasks to do. Well, your service is all you have. A slave enslaves themselves, indentured servant, because they have no money. They have no land, no possessions.
That's right.
So they're saying, I have nothing. All I can give is my work.
Right.
And so your work's what you give. That's what it is. But there's nothing else to give. You have nothing else. The shirt off your back is empty. So your service of tasks you give is what you have, and you have no possessions.
Right.
So all you have is what can you do? That's what he's after. Makes sense? That's the service you do. That's all you can give. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, it's if you're bought with a price, you decide to stay. You talk about with the bond servant forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Apostle Paul talks about being bond servants. So thus, you know, the gift that we're given, kind of the John 3:16, great, that's an offering for everybody, but do you want to stay?
Right. The decision has to be made. You have to make that choice. I'm staying versus I'm running away. I'm leaving. Almighty God, a great Heavenly Father, thank you for our Shabbat day of service, day of studying to listen. Please, Father, help us to learn what is good and right in your eyes, to follow you wherever you lead us, even though we may not know where it is. Father, grant us peace and patience to know that you know what's best for us and that you are always right. We ask your blessing on the rest of us, the rest of our afternoon, Father. We praise you in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.